Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information is available at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfoodtons.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds of citizens and groups have rallied in support of Lieutenant Aaron Watana, who is refusing deployment.
Four Ohio politicians were charged today for ethics violations, shaking an already controversial Republican-led state government.
The Israeli military has launched a wide-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip, forcing Palestinian militants to release an abducted soldier.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,526 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 43,140 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website informationclearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate is as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 28th, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. West Coast lawmakers won House approval Wednesday of $2 million for salmon fishermen suffering from a sharply curtailed fishing season. The money is a fraction of the $81 million that lawmakers want. But frustrated over the Bush administration's failure to declare a disaster to help the fishermen, lawmakers hope the vote will keep the door open to add more money later. The amendment would move $2 million from the Commerce Department's administrative funds into the general fund of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to help the fishermen.
The Forest Service yesterday officially awarded the first timber sale in a pristine roadless area since the Bush administration rolled back the Roadless Area Protection Rule.
Mike's Gulch fire salvage sale late yesterday afternoon to the Silver Creek Timber Company. That timber sale purchaser needs to do a couple things now that it's been awarded. They need to submit an operating plan to the Forest Service and submit their performance bond. Once that happens, they're free to operate, so we expect them to be completing that in the next couple days. There is pending litigation on Biscuit, and if at any time that pending litigation entails for the Biscuit operations to stop, the Forest Service will obey the law and the courts.
That was Patricia Burrell, spokeswoman for the Forest Service. Meanwhile, Governor Kulongoski and environmental groups are still holding the courts, hoping the courts will rule in their favor in time to prevent the logging. The governor wants the Forest Service to hold off on logging until lawsuits challenging the Bush administration's new roadless area rule can be heard.
The Surgeon General issued a report yesterday that recommends a smoking ban for all public places. He says separating smokers from non-smokers in a building doesn't protect the non-smokers from secondhand smoke. But is the report enough to increase support for a statewide smoking ban in Oregon? Members of the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon says they'll have the Surgeon General's report in hand come the next state legislative session. They plan to lobby hard in 2007 for a statewide ban on smoking. But many restaurant and bar owners in Oregon argue the ban will hurt business. But the Surgeon General says the only way to protect yourself from the dangers of secondhand smoke is to never get near it. Smoking ban supporters in Oregon say now is the time for legislators to listen up and make a change for the good of the public. Oregon recently did an air monitoring project inside restaurants and bars in the state. The project studied a number of bars and restaurants in a handful of locations around the state this year. The testing found the amount of potentially harmful particles in bars and restaurants with smoking to be higher than EPA safety levels.
A sweeping plan to create universal health care in Oregon by putting all public medical money in one pot found plenty of support last night in Medford at former Governor John Kitzhaber's Archimedes Project Roadshow. wearing his signature jeans and cowboy boots. The former two-term governor and architect of the Oregon Health Plan said medical costs are the number two cause of personal bankruptcy, are driving the national debt of $9 trillion, and are crippling American businesses in the global market. If passed by the 2007 legislature or a later state ballot measure, Kitzhaber's plan would require waivers of Medicare and Medicaid rules to allow universal coverage in Oregon. Kitzhaber says it would also force a debate on a Congress that's unwilling to revisit the choices made when the present system was created half a century ago.
Although Oregonians vote on paper ballots, our elections may be vulnerable to attack by computer hackers. This, according to a report released yesterday, which found all three of the nation's most commonly used electronic voting machines have serious security flaws. The report by NYU's Brennan Center for Justice says these flaws could threaten the integrity of state and national elections. KBOO's Jacob Fenston has more.
Oregon voters cast their votes by mail using paper ballots, but those ballots are then tallied by electronic optical scan machines. Those optical scanners, according to the report released yesterday by the Brennan Center, are vulnerable to attack by insertion of corrupt software. The report recommends states conduct manual vote audits, comparing a hand count of a portion of votes to the machine-tallied results. Currently, only 12 states require such audits. Oregon is not one of those states. But Oregon Secretary of State Bill Bradbury says we don't need audits. He says election officials conduct tests on voting machines that ensure they're counting correctly. These tests are conducted with a deck of test ballots 5 days before the count, the morning of, and the evening after.
It would take some kind of a real wizard of a programmer to figure out how to tell it to count correctly all those times, but incorrectly somewhere in the middle.
Oregon Secretary of State Bill Bradbury. But voting rights activists say these tests aren't enough. Kathleen Wynn of Black Box Voting says the machines could be programmed to perform differently in a test mode.
So you're actually testing the machine to see how it would test in this test, but you don't really aren't testing it in an actual how it would perform in a live election. They're totally different modes. It's just being tested and saying it passed a test, but it didn't pass the election.
Voting rights advocates say voting machines are also subject to malfunctions and programming errors. Oregon's ballots are scanned on machines made by Election Systems and Software. It's a company with a history of ballot programming errors, says John Gideon, executive director of VotersUnite.org. He's compiling a list of ES&S programming errors during this year's primary season. So far, 33 counties across the country have blamed ES&S for programming errors.
We're in primary season right now, and the vendors are not having any luck at all supporting the elections that are going on. Machines are failing. They can't get technical support out. What's going to happen in November when they have elections in 50 states all at the same time, and we have these problems? It's going to be a disaster.
Gideon says election officials are no longer in control of elections because they rely on private companies to program voting machines. The software provided is proprietary and not subject to public scrutiny. John Adams with Oregon Voter Rights Coalition says mandatory manual audits are the only way to make sure a machine count is accurate.
Without any kind of verification that would tell us whether the final result is accurate or true, we're really doing a faith-based election system.
The Brennan Center Task Force makes several other recommendations to beef up voting security. The report advocates a nationwide ban on wireless components in voting machines, which are currently legal in 48 states. The task force, which spent over a year preparing the report, was composed of private sector scientists and voting machine and security specialists. The group included many of the nation's foremost experts. John Adams says Oregon has a good election system that could be made better.
Oregon has, by and large, among the most professional and conscientious election officials, and we can be the leader in doing the best system in the country, we believe. We think that the vote by mail has allowed, at least in Oregon's implementation, it has allowed a lot of the problems that other states have to be overcome.
For KBOO News, I'm Jacob Fenston.
COSA, Oregon's Immigrant Rights Coalition, and Voz Hispana Cosa Chavista, a Woodburn-based organization dedicated to organizing Latino voters, tomorrow kick off a major voter registration drive in Oregon. The project is called Democracy Summer, and organizers say they plan to build on the national strikes and street actions staged throughout the spring. COSA plans a series of community forums around the state to inform immigrants about the Senate immigration bill and to motivate eligible immigrants and Latino voters to register to vote. Voz Hispana plans a voter registration drive focused on Latinos in Marion County. Also planned are citizen workshops, voter registration drives, and teach-ins on pending legislation in Congress. Over 50 cities all over the country will begin Democracy Summer activities on July 1st.
This is...
To find out more, call 503-984-6816 or go to www.oregoncausa.org.
A new report by the Oregon Center for Public Policy shows that Initiative Petition 6, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, would make recessions worse in Oregon. Not only does Initiative Petition 6 fail to create a rainy day fund, the researchers said it would undermine any rainy day fund that the legislature might later create by including unemployment insurance under the spending scheme. The Oregon initiative is modeled on Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights, commonly referred to as TABOR, and considered the nation's harshest spending limit. The Oregon researchers emphasize that Oregon's initiative goes a step further than Colorado's TABOR by counting unemployment insurance payments against the TABOR limit, effectively eliminating the spending growth that the measure's proponents claim to allow. Last November, Colorado voters suspended use of TABOR for 5 years after Republican Governor Bill Owens, business leaders, and the state legislator agreed that TABOR was damaging Colorado's universities, healthcare system, road maintenance, and other crucial public services.
If you're having a hard time figuring out where political candidates stand on issues, you're not alone. Project Vote Smart says political candidates are less and less likely to clearly state their positions on issues important to voters. KBOO's Jacob Fenston speaks with Rachel Pagliauca about Project Vote Smart's candidate questionnaire recently sent out to Oregon's candidates.
The National Political Awareness Test, the test that we send out each election year to candidates across the country, all different offices, testing their willingness to respond to issue questions that are important to voters. And so we send this test out to candidates in Oregon June 14th. And then if they say yes, they are willing to answer questions, we basically ask them to prove it. We ask them to fill out, answer a few questions on important issues. The candidates that respond and the candidates who fail to respond, their responses are posted on the website or something that's saying that they refuse to show their willingness.
What kind of response do you get? Have you gotten responses yet? Do you usually get most candidates responding or not?
No, we don't typically. The response rates actually have gone down. I think starting in 2000, we started documenting that both political parties are telling their candidates not to respond to the test because it makes them stray off their campaign message, and it also leaves them open for opposition research. But to that we just say, if you're not willing to let your opponents know where you stand, how can voters possibly know where you stand?
Why is this important for them to respond to these kind of questionnaires?
Well, it's so hard for voters to get information now about all these races, and it kind of shows the kind of candidates are running if they're not willing to respond to the questions. I mean, I think that we all need to encourage these candidates to respond.
That was Rachel Pagliauca of Project Vote Smart speaking with KBOO's Jacob Fenston. Pagliauca says Oregon voters should encourage their candidates to respond to the questionnaires before the July 26th deadline.
A website run by a controversial church group that has picketed at the funerals of soldiers killed in Iraq indicates plans are underway to picket two such funerals in Oregon. The inflammatory protests have drawn fire from many quarters and even prompted some lawmakers to draft legislation in order to create distance between the group and soldiers' families. The Westboro Baptist Church, led by Fred Phelps, has protested at many funerals, claiming soldiers are in hell because they fought for a country that tolerates homosexuality. At many of the funerals in other areas of the United States, motorcycle clubs bearing large American flags have inserted themselves between the Westover protesters and families, sometimes gunning their engines as the family passes by to drown out the protesters. The protesters, sometimes with children, carry signs that read, "God hates America," and "Thank God for 9/11," as well as signs attacking homosexuals and other religious groups.
Northwest senators voted along party lines today on a constitutional amendment to ban flag desecration. The proposal died in a Senate cliffhanger. The vote was 66 to 34 in favor of the amendment, one vote short of the two-thirds needed to send it to the states for ratification. Among Northwest lawmakers, Democratic Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell of Washington State and Ron Wyden of Oregon opposed the amendment. Republicans Gordon Smith of Oregon and Larry Craig and Mike Crapo of Idaho supported it. Craig said desecration of the flag in the name of free speech destroys the symbol of that very freedom. But Cantwell said that although she understands the desire to protect the flag and doesn't condone its desecration, the strength of the nation lies in people's ability to tolerate dissent.
The Supreme Court ruled against two foreign suspects today, including an Oregon case about whether an international treaty required police to inform them that they had a right to contact their governments when they were arrested. By a 6-3 vote, justices did not decide whether a 1969 treaty signed by the United States and several other countries require suspects to be informed of such a right. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts said the two men, one from Honduras, the other from Mexico, are not entitled to suppression of statements to police or another chance to raise objections based on the treaty after failing to do so at the trial. The United States is one of 168 countries that signed the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, which requires competent authorities to tell a consulate when one of its citizens has been arrested. But police in the United States do not routinely tell arrested foreign nationals that they can call their consulates.
In Soweto, South Africa, thousands of black school children took to the streets in 1976 to demand a democratic government. Around the world, that day is commemorated as the Day of the African Child. KBOO's Marlise Franklin covered Portland's celebration of the event. Here's her report.
In Portland, the World Forestry Center hosted the Day of the African Child. Various groups attended, such as the Harambee Center, the World Affairs Council, the African Women's Coalition, Mercy Corps, and Africa AIDS Response. Chada Addy provided the entertainment and invited the children to a drumming circle. Another attendee was Katie Reed. She has just freshly graduated from Southridge High School in Beaverton. She is the executive director for the Sister School Project at Southridge. She explains how she and her colleagues have worked with the Harambee Center to join the cultures of Ugandan high school students and students in Oregon.
The program that we run at Southridge High School is called the Matale Sister School Project, which started about 2 years ago, and it's a wonderful program that bridges American high schools with high schools in Eastern Africa. And the way it works is that we take American high school students and we pair them up with a school, and our school is called St. Andrews, and it's in Matale, Uganda. The school there is about 400 kids, and over half of them have been orphaned because of AIDS. And we've been bridging the two schools and doing a student sponsorship program so that these students are able to go to school. And we've also been learning a whole lot about each other. So we have a pen pal program where we exchange letters, and almost all students at Southridge now have pen pals with students at St. Andrews in Matale.
Katie talks about how she was inspired to start the project.
The reason I started the Student Sponsorship Fund is as a result of meeting Thomas, who is an amazing success story. And Thomas Luebiga is from the school then in Uganda and had been sponsored himself and then was sponsored at the University of Oregon and now works at Nike. I just really see the impact of this project as you sponsor one student.
In the community where I grew up, in southern Uganda, it is the district that probably is the most impacted by the AIDS epidemic in Uganda. I was seeing a generation of kids that are growing up that are not going to good school. Their parents had been educated. Now that work is lost because their parents are dead, and this generation is going to be lost.
We've been called the Generation Fix, and that we really have a lot of power and a lot of voice as youth, and that I think we're sometimes underestimated for the impact that we can make.
Dr. Mark Matabani was a keynote speaker at the Day of the African Child. He wrote the book Kaffir Boy and other books which celebrate the power of knowledge, our common humanity, and the resiliency of the human spirit. Here is an excerpt from his speech.
My mother, by her example, taught, she said, "My son, it is very easy to see the world through your eyes. Try to see it through the eyes of others. Try to feel their pain. Try to do something to alleviate it. Try to recognize that regardless of how wrong they may be, that they too are still human. And it was going down this road, the road of empathy, that I was able to save my own humanity.
This is Marlise Franklin at the Day of the African Child at the World Forestry Center in Portland, Oregon, for KBOO News.
Millions of Mormon crickets are migrating across the western United States, devouring everything in their path as they march in unison across wide swaths of land from Idaho to Oregon. The insects form huge bands to protect themselves from predators as they march across the countryside in a desperate search for protein. Although their wings are too feeble for them to fly, they can move more than a mile in a single day, driven partly by fear of cannibalism. According to Patrick Lorch, an insect behaviorist at Kent State University, who started studying Mormon crickets because he was interested in their mating patterns, says even their mating changes dramatically in a protein-deficient environment. Some states, including Oregon, have issued warnings to motorists because of the debris from squash crickets can make a highway as slippery as ice.
Upheld a congressional district map redrawn by Texas Republicans in 2003, except for that part of the map discriminating against Latino voters. The number of wars worldwide has declined, but the definition of conflict is also shifting, according to a new international study. And how did Sir Ernie Fletcher, governor of Kentucky, cross the street? Here's a story about our nation's governors and their preferential modes of transportation. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Last night, we featured an interview with Lieutenant Aaron Watada. As part of our ongoing series of interviews, tonight we hear from retired Colonel Ann Wright, known as the Commandante of Camp Casey. She shares her views on current affairs, the war in Iraq, and the growing resistance movement within the military. KBOO's Jim Thompson reports.
Ann Wright was one of the many military and government officials who quit their position in protest of the Iraq War. She was a colonel in the Army, and her career included 29 years in the military and 16 years in the diplomatic corps. I'm speaking with her on her cell phone. Ann, first question. You made quite a shift with your resignation and subsequent activism, and I gather from reading about your life and career that the Axis of Evil speech was a kind of tipping point for you. Would you say that speech, or any other event, triggered a change within you, or was it just that you were responding to a changed world?
Well, the Axis of Evil speech was clarifying on one thing. I was in Afghanistan. I had helped reopen the embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan in December of 2001. And then when the president talked about this Axis of Evil in his State of the Union speech in January of 2002, it answered some questions we had been having about why we weren't in Afghanistan getting the economic development funds that we needed and why there wasn't a larger U.S. military presence there. That indeed the shift had already moved in Washington from Afghanistan to Iraq. And as we've seen over the last 4 years, the attention that the United States has really paid toward Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan has been almost minimal compared to the hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops that we put into Iraq. And indeed, it was what really shifted me, though, was the decision of the administration to invade and occupy an oil-rich Muslim country that had not done anything to the United States. That's why I resigned.
Just last month, you were arrested for distributing flyers for the movie Sir No Sir. The film is about the resistance movement within the military in the Vietnam era. Is there any similar movement going on today within the ranks?
Yes, there is. And actually, I was just detained for placing little postcard-sized flyers that announced that the movie was going to be shown only for 3 days in Washington. And I happened to be on one of the military bases in Washington at Fort McNair. So I thought, well, I'll just place a few of these postcards around. And one young military police sergeant came up to me and said, "Man, these are seditious material, and I'll have to detain you and investigate this." So he handcuffed me and then shackled me to a chair. Here is a retired colonel in the Army. Anyway, it certainly got a lot of publicity for the film. And GI resistance in Vietnam, as we all know, because of the draft, was substantial. But even without the draft, in this volunteer army that we have right now, there is a lot of GI resistance to the war in Iraq. There are over 8,000 men and women who are now AWOL from the military. And to me, it's a, you know, some people say, oh, gosh, you know, you shouldn't support anybody that goes AWOL from the military. But when a person makes a determination that they cannot participate in what they feel is an illegal war, and since I myself actually resigned from my government service because of it, I think it's totally appropriate to support them. So there is resistance to this war in Iraq.
One of the big recent stories is of the two soldiers captured near Yosefiya and apparently brutally executed. One of them, Private Thomas Tucker, was from nearby Madras, Oregon. Can you comment on that? And do you think there will be any collective retaliation as there was in Fallujah?
Well, it's a tragedy every time any of our soldiers are killed. It's a tragedy when Iraqis are killed. It's a tragedy when whoever killed those two soldiers who are so barbaric and brutal in the manner in which they went about killing them. I mean, it's atrocious. I would hope that there's not, when the U.S. military tries to do a retaliation thing, it means that innocent women and children are going to get swept up in this, similar to what happened in Haditha, where we have 24 innocent men and women that were just shot by the Marines in retaliation for one of their buddies getting killed. It's human nature that you don't want your buddies killed, but this retaliation sort of thing is just something that is a never-ending cycle, and it doesn't do any good to start that sort of stuff because, I mean, the U.S. has been brutal toward elements of the Iraqi people. The insurgents are brutal toward ours. It's a never-ending cycle, and it can just keep escalating and escalating. So while I'm horrified about what happened to those soldiers, I certainly hope we are not going in for a bloodbath and retaliation. Because 10-1, you'll never get the people that actually kill those two.
Thank you so much. That was Ann Wright, and I'm Jim Thompson for KBOO News.
And in a related story, people gathered in 34 cities across the nation yesterday to show their support for Lieutenant Aaron Watada, who was being held at Fort Lewis, Washington, after refusing to deploy last week with the 3rd Stryker Brigade. Lieutenant Watada is the first commissioned officer to refuse deployment to Iraq. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has more.
John Nettleton was one of the members of Veterans for Peace who gathered yesterday on the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland, Oregon, about 2 hours south of Fort Lewis.
I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I served in a war that was somewhat questionable itself, and I just have a lot of appreciation for this young man that's not claiming to be a conscientious objector. He's claiming that this is an illegal war.
A native of Hawaii, the 28-year-old Watada enlisted in the Army in 2003 and spent a year in Korea. When he redeployed to Fort Lewis and learned that he would be sent to Iraq, he says he tried to learn everything he could about the conflict. After extensive research, he concluded that the war in Iraq is illegal under international and domestic law. Prior to his confinement at Fort Lewis, Lieutenant Watada spoke in Portland.
I believe that I am fulfilling my oath, that I am disobeying an unlawful order, and I would hope that the military, though highly doubtful, will give me a fair trial and allow me to debate the legality of the war.
Lieutenant Watada faces a possible court-martial and 2 to 5 years in a military prison for disobeying a lawful order. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
The Pentagon is pushing to eliminate language from new detainee policies referring to a central principle of the Geneva Convention, explicitly banning humiliating and degrading treatment. Critics say such a step would mark a further shift away from strict adherence to international human rights standards. The Pentagon's decision came as 2 previously secret Army investigative reports on prisoner abuse were released to the American Civil Liberties under a Freedom of Information Act request. The more than 1,000 pages turned over to the ACLU included one report by Army Brigadier General Richard Formica on Special Operation Forces in Iraq and another by Brigadier General Charles Jacoby on Afghanistani detainees.
In California, the city of Berkeley has placed a referendum on the November ballot to allow voters to weigh in on an impeachment of President George W. Bush. FSRN's Eric Klein has more.
While dozens of city councils around the country have passed resolutions supporting impeachment
Organizers say that Berkeley is now the first to put the question to the voters. Founder of Gold Star Mothers for Peace, Cindy Sheehan, was officially recognized last night as one of Berkeley's newest residents. She addressed the council to encourage them to put the impeachment referendum on the ballot.
If anybody has committed impeachable offenses against the people of America, against the world, it is George Bush, Dick Cheney, and the rest of the administration.
The referendum will call on Congress to implement impeachment proceedings for President Bush and Vice President Cheney for crimes they've committed while in office, including spying on citizens without a warrant, illegally detaining citizens and non-citizens without due process, advocating and encouraging torture, and misleading Congress and the American people in order to launch the war on Iraq. While such a referendum voted on at the city level is purely symbolic, organizers with Constitution Summer, a student-led movement for impeachment, say that symbolic acts are needed to spark a national debate that is long overdue. Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked documents known as the Pentagon Papers that increased public outrage over the Vietnam War, spoke at last night's Berkeley City Council meeting.
What if they gave a constitutional crisis and nobody noticed? That's what seems to be happening in this country right now. It's not the first constitutional crisis. We had a president almost 40 years ago now who said, when the president does it, it's not illegal. He was wrong, and Congress told him he was wrong by being on the verge of impeachment and causing his resignation. That isn't going to happen right now with the incumbent's party in control of both houses of Congress and increasingly in the courts. But unless the citizens of this country recognize and tell the world, we understand that he is violating the Constitution, many of us, including me, fought for and would give our lives for, unless we notice that that is happening, we will be like the citizens of another country who let their democracies go away very quickly.
Organizers with Constitution Summer are working on getting other cities to put an impeachment referendum on the ballot in November to add to Berkeley's. For FSRN, I'm Eric Klein.
In a scandal that has shaken Ohio's Republican-dominated government, four Ohio politicians pled no contest today to ethic violations. Lucas County Commissioner Maggie Thurber, Toledo City Councilwoman Betty Schultz, former Toledo Mayor Donna Owens, and former State Representative Sally Peirce were fined $1,000 each on misdemeanor charges of failing to report gifts worth more than $75. They were accused of receiving money from prominent GOP donor Tom Noe, then contributing it to President Bush's re-election campaign in their own names, in an alleged scheme by Noe to skirt laws limiting individual contributions to $2,000. The four bring to 14 the number of people charged in the scandal centered on Noe, who was hired by the Ohio Workers' Compensation Bureau to manage a $50 million investment in rare coins. Noe pleaded guilty last month to giving $45,000 directly or indirectly to two dozen friends and associates who then donated the money in their names to the Bush campaign. He is awaiting trial on state charges of embezzling more than $1 million from the coin fund.
The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld a congressional district map redrawn by Texas Republicans in 2003, but it ruled that part of the map discriminates against Latino voters. From KFPT in Houston, FSRN's Renee Feltz reports.
Democrats allege the Texas GOP engaged in political gerrymandering when they redrew House district lines with help from then-House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Today's 5-4 decision stayed away from this political argument and approved the GOP effort. In the process, the court upheld the right of states to change their congressional district lines more often than the traditional every 10 years. In its narrow ruling, the court found one part of the map discriminates against minorities. Rice University political scientist Bob Stein.
The goal was to identify racial or ethnic dilution. They focused only on Henry Bonilla's district and said that there was a significant movement of Hispanic voters out of the district, and there was a dilution of minority interest. That's a Voting Rights Act violation.
Stein says the implications of the court's ruling will extend beyond the boundaries of this one district, which extends from San Antonio into West Texas. Responsibility for drawing the map goes back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, but it's unclear if the lower court must issue a new map now or by 2008. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz at KPFT in Houston.
Walmart Stores Incorporated affirmed its support for an increase in the federal minimum wage after its chief lobbyist in Washington was quoted today as saying the nation's largest employer was neutral on the issue. Chief Executive Lee Scott, who made headlines last October when he first backed an increase in the $5.15 hourly pay rate, said today he still supports a raise. Walmart says it pays well above the minimum wage, an average of $10.11, for full-time employees in the U.S. Scott said many Walmart customers are low-income families and would benefit from increased wages because they struggle from month to month. Scott spoke after the publication Roll Call quoted Lee Culpepper, Walmart's chief lobbyist, as saying Scott's comments were misinterpreted last fall and that Walmart did not back a minimum wage increase.
Native American leaders spoke on Capitol Hill today, highlighting the dire situation of housing in many of their communities. They criticized a recent decision by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development to freeze money meant for Native American public housing agencies. Darby Hickey reports from Washington, D.C.
Housing in Native American communities is in a state of emergency. That was the message of tribal leaders speaking at an oversight hearing today held by the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. Poverty rates for Native Americans are twice the average of the rest of the country and compounded by substandard conditions found in housing. According to the Census Bureau, overcrowded housing in tribal areas is almost three times the national average, while Native American homes are 11 times more likely to lack plumbing or kitchen facilities. The Honorable James Steele Jr. of Confederate Salish and Kootenai Tribes says that the current budget for the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act is completely inadequate.
If funding levels from FY02 had been maintained with the modest inflation, the FY07 appropriation should be approximately $748 million, not $625 million, as contained in the President's budget. Without some increase in funding for our housing authority, and many others are forced to make tough decisions on cutting programs, decreasing the level of maintenance of existing units, and not being able to leverage funding to create new affordable housing opportunities.
Steele says that another major problem is the June 9th decision by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, to freeze all unspent funds from Indian Housing Block Grants from fiscal year 2006. That move could bankrupt dozens, if not hundreds, of Native American housing agencies, says Marty Shervloff. Shervloff is chairman of the National American Indian Housing Council.
NAIHC is gravely concerned about HUD's recent decision to potentially withhold allocation of the remaining fiscal year 2006 funds if the department is unable to obtain a stay. Their decision to withhold funds for hundreds of tribes may be outside of HUD's legal authority.
Over $300 million have been frozen by HUD, almost half of the total budget of the program. The National American Indian Housing Council and hundreds of tribes across the country have been pressuring HUD to reverse their position. Chairman Shervloff said he believes the Senate Indian Affairs Committee agrees that HUD's actions are unfair and that the committee is likely to meet with HUD and push for change today. That sentiment was echoed during the hearing by Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska.
I do appreciate the perspective that the three of you have been able to give us and to hear the concerns raised by the panel as to the effect that tying up these funds through the Fort Peck situation can have. We recognize that, and the chairman and ranking member clearly stated the need to act in this area and to do so very quickly.
A report in 2003 by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights estimated that over 200,000 housing units are needed immediately in Indian Country and that over 90,000 Native American families are homeless or underhoused. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
In a hushed hearing room packed with hundreds of people, a single state senator yesterday derailed the second attempt to legalize assisted suicide in California before he cast the deciding vote against a measure that would have allowed people with less than 6 months to live to get a lethal prescription. Democratic Senator Joe Dunn of Santa Ana said he feared such a law would eventually be expanded. He raised the example of the Netherlands, where doctors are allowed to kill people suffering unbearable pain. After much soul-searching, Dunn said he worried that assisted suicide might eventually be extended to people who are incapacitated or disabled, but not terminally ill. After the vote, Dunn said he was alluding to a possible lack of government funding for end-of-life care or health plans that might seek to shave costs. The bill, AB 651, would have copied an 8-year-old Oregon law that allows terminally ill people to kill themselves, usually with an overdose of barbiturates, after evaluation by physicians, repeated statements of their wishes, and a 2-week waiting period. Patients must take any lethal prescription themselves without help. Like Oregon's law, the California legislation would have allowed doctors to refuse to participate.
The time is 5:40, and now another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When Bill Gates, the richest man on earth, was asked a few years ago whether he considered himself rich, he demurred by saying, "I'm clearly not by some definition middle class." Well, gosh, I guess not. By no definition are you middle class when you're sitting on a $46.5 billion fortune. Still, the powers that be keep insisting that America is a classless society, and politicians of both parties keep pursuing economic policies that are based on the happy theory that a rising tide lifts all boats. They don't like anyone pointing out that the boats of the privileged few are yachts, while most people are paddling along in leaky rowboats, and too many Americans don't even have a piece of driftwood to cling to. That aside, however, it's simply not true that America's prosperity is broadly shared. As the old saying goes, them that's got is them that gets, and them keeps getting more and more. Forget poor people and the sinking middle class, let's look only at the top 10% of money earners in our country. A recent study of income gains between 1972 and 2000 shows that if you were in the 90th percentile of income, your wages and salaries increased by 34% during this span, about 1% a year. If you were in the 99th percentile, though, your income jumped by 87%. But it's at the 99.9th percentile that the real fun begins. This is the millionaire class, and their income gain was a joyous 181%. For true joy, however, go to the 99.99 percentile. These multimillionaires saw their incomes rise by 497%. This is Jim Hightower saying, and this was before George W., whose tax and other economic policies have sent a tidal wave of new riches into those tippy-top percentiles, further widening the gap. The tide is rising, but so is the inequality, endangering our democratic society. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned for Independent Native Newscast following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, The Underground. At 7, it's non-stop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Weather this week in the Willamette Valley, highs in the mid-80s and slowly increasing throughout the week. In the Columbia Gorge, highs moving toward the 90s. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
From the African bush to Indonesia's shores, the number of wars worldwide has dropped to a new low, peace researchers report. But the phase of conflict is changing, they say, and free-for-all violence in such places as the Congo defy easy definition. Sweden's Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's newly released Yearbook 2006, drawing from data maintained by Sweden's Uppsala University, reports the number of active major armed conflicts worldwide stood at 17 in 2005, the lowest point in a steep slide from a high of 31 in 1991. The Uppsala experts added one conflict to their list in 2005, the resurgent war between the four-year-old Afghan government with its U.S.-led allies and fighters of the ousted Taliban regime. But they also subtracted three, conflicts that ended in Rwanda, southern Sudan, and Algeria. Those joined such other recent additions to their peace column as Liberia and Indonesia's Aceh province.
One day after Hamas recognizes Israeli statehood, the Israeli military launches a wide-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip. Attackers targeted two major bridges and the main power plant in Gaza, plunging half of the Gaza Strip into a total blackout. Resistance groups in the West Bank claim that they have abducted a third Israeli soldier near Etzion on the Hebron-Jerusalem road. The Palestinians are demanding that Israel release all Palestinian women and children held in captivity, some 400 prisoners. Saeed Banoura reports from Beit Sahur in the West Bank.
Negotiate for the return of an Israeli soldier abducted Sunday and a settler abducted on Monday by Palestinian resistance fighters and have instead begun a massive attack on the Gaza Strip. As the attack began, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said Israel will not shy away from extreme action to bring the soldier home. Mohammed Abdullah, a resident of Rafah and field researcher for Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, describes the ongoing attack.
A series of developments began last night with the occupation of the Gaza International Airport in Rafah by Israeli tanks and troops. We don't know what they are doing inside the airport, but we can see Israeli bulldozers working. The soldiers have been erecting sand barriers around a number of tanks. After 11 p.m. last night, the Israeli soldiers began the operation by firing with artillery that had been installed south of Rafah over the last several days. They fired 35 to 40 artillery shells in less than half an hour.
Abdul Halim Abu Samra is a spokesman of the Khan Yunis office of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights.
Since we've already been under siege for a long while in the Gaza Strip, this attack just makes things worse. Our supplies are quickly diminishing. The amount of food, medicine, baby formula in Gaza right now is barely enough for a few days. If the attack continues, there will be a massive human rights disaster here. All of the people in the Gaza Strip are suffering, but especially children and people with special needs.
The late-night assault came after a day of negotiations between the Palestinian Authority, Egypt, and Israel, negotiations which the Palestinian Authority had thought were making progress. Nabil Abu Rudaina, spokesperson of the Palestinian president.
There are Arab and Palestinian efforts, negotiations that continued until midnight last night. Then we were surprised after midnight by a sudden Israeli escalation. The Israeli forces attacked bridges, the power plant, and civilian areas. This Israeli attack came after the Palestinians reached an agreement on the National Unity Document. The attack is ongoing. Israel is trying to impose a new reality, which will not lead to peace or any positive result. Israel should stop this escalation and return to the negotiating table. Otherwise, they will simply complicate matters. Israel should know that the Palestinian Authority will go to the United Nations Security Council to ask for a condemnation of this escalation.
The Palestinian Popular Resistance Committees have announced that they will kill the abducted Israeli settler they are holding if Israel does not stop its attack. Abu Ubaidah with the Popular Resistance Committees.
We are dealing here with an enemy that does not respect agreements. This enemy will face our power and determination. We have warned them what will happen if they attack in the Gaza Strip. We will not bow down to any pressure from the Zionist enemy. If they don't respond to our demands, they will have to pay the price. They'll end up having to search for the ashes of their soldiers in the air and in the sea.
The resistance committees holding the settler and soldier captive have asked Israel for a prisoner swap, in which Israel would release some Palestinian political prisoners in exchange for the release of the two Israelis. Saeb Barakat, the Palestinian chief negotiator, said that he believes the Israeli operation, dubbed Operation Summer Rain, was planned by Israeli forces well in advance of Sunday's soldier abduction, and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called the Gaza offensive collective punishment of the Palestinian people and called for international intervention. Russia and the European Union have both criticized the invasion. This is Saeed Banoura reporting from imemc.org for Free Speech Radio News in Beit Sahour.
11 Sunni insurgent groups have offered an immediate halt to all attacks, including those on American troops, if the United States agrees to withdraw foreign forces from Iraq in 2 years, insurgent and government officials told the Associated Press today. Withdrawal is the centerpiece of a set of demands from the groups which operate north of Baghdad in the heavily Sunni Arab provinces of Salahuddin and Diyala. Although much of the fighting has been to the west, those provinces are increasingly violent and attacks there have crippled oil and commerce routes. The groups who've made contact have largely shunned attacks on Iraqi civilians, focusing instead on the U.S.-led coalition forces. Their offer coincides with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's decision to reach out to the Sunni insurgency with a reconciliation plan that includes an amnesty for fighters.
Iran's foreign minister has indicated that his country may respond before mid-July to an international package aimed at resolving a standoff over its nuclear program, a German magazine reported today. Iran received the proposals June 6th, and President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said the government will not respond officially until at least mid-August. The United States and Europe are pressing for a quicker reply.
A state in southern India is asking a judicial commission to find seed giant Monsanto in contempt of court. Binu Alex has more.
The Indian province of Andhra Pradesh has filed a contempt application against the Indian subsidiary of U.S. biotech giant Monsanto for violating the Monopolies and Restrictive Trade Practices Commission's order to reduce the price of BT cotton seeds on par with China. Monsanto had earlier lost a legal battle in Andhra over the high price of its patented BT cotton seed. But Monsanto said it has already complied with the directive by reducing the price by rupees 20 or less than 50 cents. The state government termed this as ridiculous and symbolic and cited it in its petition on Monday, asking for the court to take strict action for non-compliance. Monsanto justified the small price reduction citing difference in land productivity that exists between China and India. The petition could come up for hearing within a week's time. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
When Governor Ernie Fletcher's day is over, he leaves his Capitol office, climbs into a Lincoln Town Car driven by a state trooper, and returns to the governor's mansion, which is just across the street. Meanwhile, his administration is encouraging Kentuckians to get out and walk more for their health. The Republican governor, a physician by training, makes no apologies for riding back and forth to work. He said, quote, "I think that's been a tradition for a long time, and that's what security likes." But his do as I say, not as I do example irks some politicians. For example, Democratic State Senator Ernesto Scorsoni, a marathon runner and frequent critic of Fletcher, said, "The governor should practice what he's preaching, otherwise it smacks of being hypocritical." Across the country, several governors who live near state capitals routinely walk to work. In Iowa, Governor Tom Vilsack sometimes jogs the 3 miles from the capital to his home at the end of the workday. And in Nevada, Governor Kenny Gwynn routinely walks the 10 blocks before he had his hip replacement surgery. Also, Julian Carroll, governor from 1974 to 1979, said it would take nearly as long to get into and out of a car as it would to walk from the mansion into the Capitol. However, Governor Christine Gregoire in Washington State, Governor Rick Perry in Texas, and Governor Haley Barbour in Mississippi routinely ride to work from their homes next door.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 28th, 2006. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our AP Wire editors are Reg McGee and Lynn Molick. Tonight's audio editor is Joshua Eichen. Special thanks to reporters Jacob Fenston, Jim Thompson, and Marlise Franklin. Our engineers are Ian Campbell and Jim Thompson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News.